Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name's Patrick Gray. And on this week's show, we will be talking through all the week's security news with our good friend Adam Boileau. That's coming in just a moment. And then we'll be having a great chat about HTTP request smuggling with this week's sponsor guest, Cody Wood of Signal Sciences. And that's a really interesting chat, that one. Very much a tech conversation that has little to do with like Signal Sciences pitching products or anything like that. If you are interested in HTTP request smuggling, you want to know a bit more about that, do hang around for that interview. That is, of course, coming up in a little while. But first up, let's get into the news now with Adam Boileau. And Adam, it looks like the Uyghur population in China and the Uyghur diaspora around China are not the only minority being targeted by the Chinese state using mobile malware.
Yeah, there's some reporting about campaigns targeting Tibetans and activists involved in Tibet with, in this case, WhatsApp-delivered malware. And there does appear to be some technical ties with, you know, other bits of, with some of the same malware being deployed against the Uyghur population. So certainly, you know, ties back into the Chinese state going after everybody that it has beef with, which seems to be a lot of people.
It does sound like this one is perhaps a little bit different from the one that was targeting Uyghur Muslims, in that this is much more targeted as opposed to just, you know, everyone who visits a particular website getting their device owned.
Yeah, we do see, you know, individuals who are working in the space being targeted a bunch of times, you know, by fairly, you know, fairly dedicated sets of attackers, you know, using in some cases even the same infrastructure with different lures over the, you know, the space of a year or two. It does seem that they are getting wise to that and reporting it onwards. I didn't even know there was a Tibetan cert, but apparently there is a Tibetan cert, and they seem to be doing a pretty roaring trade in handling, you know, malware being delivered to people who are involved.
The Iranian government's cybersecurity office has a very important message for the world, Adam. We didn't get owned. We didn't get owned. You got owned. So this next piece is from the Times of Israel. Walk us through it.
Yeah, they are saying that nobody owned oil and gas infrastructure in Iran and nothing bad has happened. That seems to be the message going on here. We've seen a lot of
stories. It's interesting, isn't it? Apropos of nothing, we didn't get owned. And I'm like, I haven't even seen the reports claiming that they were, right? So I don't know where this came from.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, there's been a lot of talk about, you know, exactly what sort of cybers should be done, if any, to Iran after the attack on Saudi oil and gas infrastructure as well. And, you know, I'm sure the Times of Israel has vested interest in making sure that many people understand that nothing happened in Iran.
There's, there's a little bit more than usual happening in the Middle East at the moment. Surprise, surprise. We got a report here from Ars talking about the Tortoise Shell Group, which is apparently going a little bit wild against Saudi targets as well.
Yeah, this is a crew that's been kicking around since about the middle of last year, and they are going after, of course, the obvious target, which is systems integrators and all of the people who provide, you know, support and IT services for other companies and, you know, a whole bunch of organizations in Saudi and in the region appear to be being targeted by this group. They are preparing the battle space, as the Americans are fond of saying, and, you know, it's a sensible place to go and shore up your access, you know, in advance of, you know, needing it for something. There does seem to be some suggestion that it's tied up with the oil rig APT-34 crew, which, you know, I think is generally understood as Iran. So there is some crossover with tooling. And, of course, the, you know, the intent certainly lines up.
Yes, it does. There's a little bit of animosity there, you might say. and, look, the New York Times has published this report. And I got to read you the headline because it's kind of funny if you've been in security long enough. The urgent search for a cyber silver bullet against Iran. Now, what I love is the silver bullet has gone from being a defensive trope, and it looks like it's going to become an offensive trope, right? Which I think is kind of interesting. Interesting reversal of how this works. But yeah, the story really looks at how, as much as the United States has messed with Iran, things like Stuxnet, you know, various attacks that, you know, Cyber Command has now kind of leaked information about to the press, doesn't appear to have really changed much. I mean, we look at the physical attack just recently against Saudi Aramco, right, where it looked like some cruise missiles were used in that attack. I mean, it just doesn't seem like whacking Iran with the cyber stick does much good.
No, I mean, certainly the fact that Iran's gone from using the cyber stick against Saudi Aramco to now using the cruise missile stick, you know, does suggest that maybe the latter is a little more effective than the former. And the article kind of talks through some of the things that the US and its allies have done in the cyberspace in Iran, you know, kind of leading up to this, and kind of questions how effective those can be, you know, below the threshold of armed conflict. Because, you know, that's, I mean, sure, they could probably turn off the power, right, or turn off, you know, water supply, some real critical infrastructure, you know, and that, you know, perhaps would be an effective use of cyber in an offensive capacity to try and send a message. But the question is, kind of anything lower than that? I mean, the one that we saw talked about earlier on where they had, you know, kind of gone after some of the systems used by the group that was going after boats in the Gulf, right? And the system they were using to track locations of shipping vessels that they were going to go and, you know, intercept or whatever. You know, the RM, the database, according to the reporting, and a bunch of other kind of attacks of the systems around that. And the question is whether that was a, you know, obviously that was below the level of triggering armed response. Whether that's effective is a good question, and whether the cost of doing things at that level, you know, in terms of losing your access, in terms of showing your hand, in terms of capability, and obviously Iran's going to be sharing all of those indicators of compromises and Yarrow rules and things with, you know, North Korea and Russia and whoever else is interested, you know, whether that loss is worth it, you know, and how far up the escalation you really have to go with the cybers before it actually becomes, you know, useful, inoffensive, or even as a deterrent.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'd just pick you up on one thing, which is, you know, cutting the water supply to, say, Tehran. I mean, that's going to be legally problematic, right? Like, it's not like Cyber Command can just YOLO its way into disrupting civilian life to that degree, I would imagine, right? Like, that is not something that I would imagine is even an option. But there are some really interesting tidbits in this story, like, or some interesting points, I guess. One of them is that this whole idea of, like, you know, the US has been pushing for years that a physical response or a kinetic response to a cyber attack is something they've always said they would do. But Iran is going to think the same way, right? Like, if there is a painful cyber attack, they might launch some sort of kinetic response, and that could get you into some sort of escalatory loop, right? So there's a few interesting things here. And another interesting point they made in this article is that these types of attacks are easy to deny. And we just discussed a story where Iran was denying that its oil and gas infrastructure had been attacked, right? Whether or not it's true or not, I mean, what I'm getting at is that I guess incidents like those are kind of easy to contain, politically speaking, domestically, right? So there's not that much pain inflicted on the regime. So there's a bunch of interesting stuff in here.
Yeah, but it just kind of goes to show that the cyber war, you know, and all of the kind of, you know, stories we've had about how much it's going to be a big deal and how important it's going to be, this really kind of illustrates the limitations of cyber as a tool, you know, because of the deniability, because of the fact that it's more like, you know, espionage in some cases. And to get to the point where it really is significant enough to cause, you know, to not be easy to deny or downplay, at that point you've kind of crossed the line into, well, maybe we should just go kinetic, and now you've kind of defeated the point of the not escalatory part of the cyber. So yeah, it's I'm sure there's going to be a lot of, you know, column inches written in, you know, military journals, you know, and schools of military planning about how this is all supposed to work, but right now everyone just seems kind of confused about what to do.
Well, it is an interesting time for that reason, right? Because it's the first time we've seen it things quite get here, right? Where you've got oil refineries having rockets rain down on them. You've got, you know, well, there's an Australian surveillance plane in the Strait of Hormuz. You've got a lot happening at the moment. And it's one thing to talk about persistent engagement when it's just fully contained on the internet. But when you've got this very complicated conflict happening, yeah, I think everyone's trying to work it out, right? So let's just keep our eye on it. Now, look, you know, Iran and the US aren't the only countries playing funny buggers on the internet, of course. And according to this next report, and this is an interesting one for me, right? Because I've spoken to some of the Proofpoint people about this actor previously. The thinking is it could be APT-10, but no one's really quite sure if it's APT-10. But anyway, someone using tradecraft similar to APT-10 is getting very interested in attacking US-based utilities.
Yeah, well, it makes sense. Utilities are one of the places where these tools work really, really well. And going into a bunch of utilities makes a lot of sense, unfortunately. And it's concerning, of course, seeing the campaign step up around, you know, the energy sector, because, you know, everything needs electricity.
the sheer amount of activity at the moment of everybody getting up all up in everybody else's grids. Like, I remember it wasn't that long ago, maybe 2 years ago even, when you would hear news about, say Russian operators even just doing some scanning and probing of US infrastructure, and that would be major news. And now it's like, a group that may or may not be APT-10 is owning up a whole bunch of US utilities, and it's like, what are we at? Like item 5 in the news sheet, right?
Yeah, exactly right. And I think the main concern for utilities is going to be availability from just the sheer number of actors that are operating in their environments and, you know, stepping on each other's toes. Surely that's going to
they're going to run out of RAM on their boxes, are they? From all of the shells. look, you know, North Korea and everybody's, you know, what I've noticed in this week's stories is everybody's doing what everybody does, right? Like, we got some North Korean malware popping up in Indian banks, right, as well this week.
Yeah, this is a story about a campaign targeting actual ATMs in India. The North Koreans, of course, would like a little bit of money. ATMs have money in them. Why not combine these two needs? And they've been working on some more up-to-date strains of ATM malware that they seem to be rolling out.
Now, look, Russia, if you're listening, as they say, we're not going to leave you out, okay? We are not going to leave you out. We've got a couple of Russia stories here as well, because we've got to hit all of these actors. Shareholders have alleged that FedEx covered up the extent of the damages inflicted upon it by the NotPetya, I was going to say ransomware outbreak, but it wasn't really ransomware, the NotPetya wiper attack. Let's go with that. The allegation here is a bunch of executives, you know, kind of minimized or downplayed the impact from NotPetya while selling off a bunch of stock, and that's not really gone down too well with shareholders. So what are we talking about here? Is this is a lawsuit, isn't it?
Yeah, so this is shareholders alleging that they didn't really come up with the full cost of the attacks on, actually, I think it was a FedEx subsidiary, the TNT Express subsidiary that got hit by NotPetya. They didn't really come up front with how much that was going to cost in terms of lost business. And then the fact that their execs were selling shares at, you know, $100 a head more than what they are now made something in the order of, you know, $30, $40 million between them whilst knowing what the full extent of damage was, whilst the shareholders didn't. That seems to be the guts of it, and it doesn't look particularly good when you're flogging off your shares as the boss.
Yeah, well, I guess, you know, they still wanted their millions of dollars. Who could blame them? Well, that's right, it's illegal. So we'll have to see where that one goes. And yeah, look, you know, while we're talking about Russia, some researchers, I think from Checkpoint and another company called Interza, which I can't say I've heard of them. They're an Israeli company. There's so many Russian crews out there. They've basically released a sort of like a tool and data set to help people visualize all of this Russian activity.
Yeah, Interza are a company that seem to make tools for doing kind of analysis of malware and looking at, you know, common bits of code, common strings, that kind of thing, and doing that sort of, you know, pseudo-genetic analysis of malware samples to look at code sharing and that kind of thing. Anyway, their tooling was used to analyze a whole bunch of samples of Russian malware and tools and things from VirusTotal and then kind of clustered together based on shared aspects. So you can kind of see the little islands of common code that, you know, kind of identify individual crews operating in Russia. And it's kind of an interesting way to look at the data set. And of course, you know, they're pushing their the ability of their tool to be able to then classify other things using that set of data, which is, you know, kind of where they're heading as a business model, I think. It's certainly interesting. And if you, you know, work in malware analysis, I'm sure you'll be, have a fun, you know, lunchtime exploring the data set.
Yeah, it's interesting actually, because their data visualizations look a lot like the ones that I've seen screen grabs of from Constellation, which is the one that the Australian Signals Directorate released, I think, last month in August. That type of malware visualization stuff, like it's pretty cool stuff. So people can go and have a look in this week's show notes, click through to the article, and then you'll find it that way, and you can have a play around with that. Now, look. All of those stories, right? Like, I front-loaded the show with all of those stories about all of the crazy shit all of these government-backed attackers are up to. And then we get to this story, which I think is actually a fairly interesting one. I think it's a fairly high-impact story. We've got 26 nations fronting the United Nations General Assembly. And what do they kick it off with, Adam? They kick it off by issuing a statement that says this stuff is getting out of hand and we need some norms. The statement is public. It's very reasonable stuff. And yeah, I mean, it's just 26 nations saying enough.
Yeah, because clearly we are on a path towards just so much crazy in the cyberspace in support of national interests. And yeah, maybe it's time we stop to think about what we're doing, because you just can't have every single country up in every single other country's power grids, which is the world that we currently live in. And although maybe that is the norm. But yeah, trying to establish some idea of what actual, you know, common sense relations between nations are in terms of, you know, cyber intrusion for, you know, during peacetime, of what it looks like attacking civilian infrastructure, of intellectual property stuff, and then kind of, you know, establishing some accountability and consequences for nations that choose not to abide by those norms. And obviously Russia and China have gone off to form their own working group to talk about different sets of norms that they would like to apply instead. But, you know, it's a step.
It is a step, but you do just get the sense that policymakers now are actually getting a bit rattled, right? And that's what this tells me. You know, when they're kicking off the UNGA with this statement, you kind of get the impression that it is finally being taken seriously. I mean, you know, who could have foreseen this even 5 years ago?
Yeah, I mean, certainly things have changed and really stepped up in a way that, you know, since Stuxnet have, you know, changed a lot of people's understanding of what these, you know, what these tools can do in the context of statecraft and relations and stuff. And yeah, the importance of it. And, you know, once we've seen Russia roll into Ukraine with, you know, turning off the power, and we're seeing all of the stuff going on in the Gulf, yeah, I think people are pretty rattled. And, you know, certainly when you talk to policy wonks, there's been a lot of this kind of grumble norms for a while, and looking at how the same sorts of processes have worked with, say, nuclear proliferation, and figuring out what we can do to come up with sets of norms in this space. But it's really hard to articulate, and it's really hard because of the, you know, attributability of it all.
Yeah, look, the final thing I'm going to say before we move on to other topics this week is, you know, as bad as everything is right now, and as much as, you know, CISOs who are listening to this program, they don't want to have to be worrying about foreign intelligence services owning their stuff. You know, they want to deliver electricity to their customers, stuff like that, right? So, you know, as bad as it is right now, you know, the really bad stuff hasn't begun, and I hope we don't get there, because I do feel like, God, I can't even believe I'm going to say this, but I do feel like we could see like an actual cyber war at some point in the next couple of years, right? Like, and I've always been reticent to make those sort of predictions, but it does feel like we could get there, right?
Well, it does, right? I mean, you and I know what's technically possible, right? Because when you talk to a whole bunch of people, I talk to a bunch of people that, you know, work in this area and actually do a bunch of these things, that we know what's possible. And it just seems like it's a natural consequence of where we've been going that we're going to end up doing some of those things for real.
Hooray! Hooray! Anyway. All right, moving on. And God, was InfoSec Twitter in a flap this week over news that Google's quantum computer had demonstrated quantum supremacy. Oh my God! You know, it even led a one of the Democrats running for president to tweet about how encryption was now broken. It's like, hey, buddy, stay in your lane. That's not really what's going on here. And yeah, the more you sort of dived into the paper, which I believe was first submitted for like pre-publication review and accidentally made public, and now it's been nuked. But a few people got their hands on it, and the general consensus seems to be that the thing it was really good at doing was something completely useless and uncontrollable, and we can all just go back to our days.
Yeah, I think, I mean, that was my takeaway. I don't pretend to understand a whole bunch about quantum shenanigans, but yeah, it did seem like what they were demonstrating was interesting. You know, it was a thing that people working in that field and doing research would probably find generally interesting. But there's just been a bunch of confusion, A, because of the, you know, the exact nature of the problem they were doing, which is like quantum random number distribution sort of business, which, yeah, seems like that's kind of what quantums, they're kind of random. I don't know. But then there's also this kind of, the term quantum supremacy is a term of art in that field that means a particular thing. But of course, it's been taken much more generally, you know, by, as the audience has, you know, a wider audience has consumed, you know, the stories about this. And it's just kind of got very muddied. And it sounds like, you know, Google's saying that they have made the most amazing quantums ever, when in fact, you know, they've made some interesting quantums, but it doesn't seem to be the end of, you know, RSA as we know it.
No. Although, you know, we'll talk about that a little bit later. That was clever. I see what you did there. So look, until we've got, fully functional, amazing quantum computers, we're just going to have to do things the old fashioned way. And that's what the FBI tried to do during the Phantom Secure investigation. What's great is because this Canadian guy got arrested for, apparently, and it seems more and more likely that what he was arrested for doing, this was like the national, intelligence coordinator, director or whatever, like some serious business Canadian Mountie got arrested because it looks like he was trying to offer information for sale to the founders of Phantom Secure, the makers of those encrypted telephones that were very popular with the Sinaloa cartel. But it looks like one of the things the FBI tried to do during this investigation was to get the founder of Phantom Secure to actually backdoor the system. Now, one of the funny things that comes through in this article is one of the reasons that didn't happen is because the guy is non-technical, right? And didn't know how to do it. So they tried to get him to recruit someone else from his company to do it. And he declined because I guess he didn't want to be dissolved in an acid bath by the Sinaloa cartel. How weird.
Yeah, exactly right. You would kind of hope that the FBI would be capable of backdooring this stuff kind of without his assistance. I mean, obviously, it's going to be a little bit harder to do it covertly, but like, surely they could manage to computer that stuff. How hard can it be, right, to sneak some firmware updates onto some phones and off you go? Like, surely that's the thing they can do. Surely.
Well, I don't know, man. I mean, there's a lot we don't know here, but it is interesting that because this Canadian bloke got arrested, like we're sort of looking again at Phantom Secure, and it was just such an awesome story, that one.
Yeah, we certainly have seen a few more wrinkles from the result of that Canadian guy being involved. And yeah, it's a more interesting story than initially it looked.
Yep. Now, look, speaking of, fresh details on old stories, we got some more info here on the JP Morgan Chase hack. One of the people involved has confessed to being the one who done it. What is interesting here, though, is there's a little bit more detail on what they were actually doing with that information. And it was, stuff as simple as sending like buy recommendations to some of these JP Morgan clients so that they could, presumably pretending to be JP Morgan so that they could inflate a stock price and then, a stock that they held and then sell it and whatever. But it looks like they found a way to really turn a buck on this data.
Which is kind of funny in a way, because we've seen so many novel ways of monetizing data stolen from companies over the years. And going back to 2014, which is, practically ancient times, for this kind of crime, it seems so quaint to, use it for stock pump and dump. Like, that's so retro. But clearly they still made enough money out of it because they're facing, like, this guy's facing what, 15 to 20 years, something like that, with a maximum of 95 years in jail. So you better hope he made some good money out of it.
Yeah, I mean, what I found interesting about that is that quite often, some of those pump and dumps, right, they're going to be people actually breaking into share accounts and directly issuing trades from people's accounts, whereas all they were doing was like spamming by the looks of things. That's what I'm getting from this article. Is that what you understood as well?
Yeah, that seems to be what I was doing. They were just using the information and being able to send, sending an email that's very convincing when it's got all the details from your account, then, kind of helps lend legitimacy to it. But yeah, and if that's all it takes, then, maybe it's not so stupid.
Yeah, it's not stupid if it works, as we always say. Exactly. Okay, so here's something that worked that was stupid, all right? the kid who hacked TalkTalk, right, apparently took over EtherDelta. There's so many layers to this story. This one's the funny one for the week. This company, a cryptocurrency exchange, EtherDelta, like they owned it sideways, but they did it the dumb way, like that was immediately noticed, managed to... Just talk us through the attack. It's so dumb. Like, no wonder he got caught.
Yeah, so this kid got the details of it, turned out to be like the CEO of EtherDelta from some, like commercial database dump on some underground forum, got the guy's phone number and email address and other details, and then talked his telco into redirecting his phone calls, used that to bypass 2FA on their Cloudflare account, I think it was.
They started with G Suite and then moved up to Cloudflare. Right. But they wound up changing the domain, the DNS settings, right? So everybody winds up going to the attacker's page and they harvest creds that way. Like, could you think of a way to do this that would raise more red flags and get shut down any quicker? Yeah, they got away with a bunch of money, but well, they didn't get away with it. They managed to temporarily abscond with some cash, which I'm guessing has been returned to the people who originally owned it. But oh my God, man. Like, this is the exception to the rule that if it works, it's not stupid.
Well, I mean, the fact that they're facing jail probably means it didn't work very well. But yeah, like, it was not a smooth hack. And given where they were, like, they jacked email and Gmail, they jacked Cloudflare for proxy, and they then jacked the DNS control panel, they had all the creds. Surely you could have done a better job than just redirecting it and then, you know, and stealing credentials from the customers. Like, there had to be a smoother way of doing that. And yeah, I guess they're paying the price for that now.
They had the goose that lays the golden eggs, and they just threw it immediately into a wood chipper. Dumbasses.
Must anyway. Be an exciting evening, though, right? I mean,
yeah, totally. Hey, I mean, they were young, right? So I'm sure it was. Yeah, I'm sure it was like that. It was very exciting. oh God, these this software, and I hadn't heard of it, and I didn't know software like this necessarily existed. But it totally makes sense when you read about it. You know, we got WordPress for blogs, we got Magento for shops, and apparently there's this package called Click2Gov, which is a similar type of prepackaged web application that is used by municipalities and local governments to do things like people can pay fines and do whatever. And a bunch of local governments are having some issues here because they're getting owned left, right, and center via presumably bugs in Click2Gov.
Yeah. Now, what's interesting here is that they got breached a couple of years ago, and it looked like at that point it was probably bugs in WebLogic or something, because of course you'd build something like this out of Oracle WebLogic because, great choice of software stack. Anyway, they got a bunch of owned and they lost a whole bunch of card data, a couple of years ago, subsequently got patched. And then this round appears to be either the same attackers who left the backdoors kicking around or somebody else who's got a bug somewhere else in the software stack that hasn't yet been patched, going around and basically just redoing the same attack. In some cases, the exact same municipalities getting yet more cards stolen. So, it's not clear whether it was just incident response that didn't go far enough or whether there is a new bug and we're going to see a whole bunch of other compromises of other areas that use the same software.
Facebook still mopping up after the Cambridge Analytica scandal. Adam, they have just suspended tens of thousands of apps across from 400 developers. And of course, these apps were suspended for, perhaps being a little bit too familiar with the old Facebook API there.
Yeah, they've been going through, obviously, looking for apps that use data in ways they're not supposed to or have access to a whole bunch of data. They've also been cleaning up, apparently, test accounts or test applications that developers had kind of set up and then were never actually used. So they've been cleaning up some of that as well. They've also filed a few lawsuits in some cases where app developers were, egregiously flouting the rules or weren't participating in Facebook's investigations to see what had happened to the data. Now, obviously, Facebook needs to be seen to be doing something after the Cambridge Analytica mess, and I'm sure they are probably quite earnest about trying to clean up some of this, some of the mess that's been made in their app ecosystem. But 400 developers and a few tens of thousands of apps doesn't seem like that much given the size of the platform.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it just comes down to that whole idea of like, why would you even have apps? And I get that there was a bit of pressure on Facebook because not allowing apps to access, their service could be seen as anti-competitive and yada, yada, yada. But like, this is what happens, right? This is how you get ants.
Yeah, well, exactly. And clearly they got a whole bunch of ants, right?
They certainly did. One of the journalists behind the big hack story, of course, the Bloomberg big hack story alleging that rice-sized chips were being inserted on Supermicro motherboards as a part of a global hardware supply chain infiltration campaign. This story looked to me, at least, to be completely fabricated. Whether that was by bad sources or by the journalists themselves, I do not know. But testing your sources against fabrication is usually a good idea. One of those journalists has now been promoted, Adam. Great job too. Looks like a fantastic job.
Yes, apparently he is taking on the role of a cybersecurity czar at the news outlet. So I guess he's on the hunt for rice-sized chips there as well. We've got to watch out for the back doors all up in Bloomberg stuff, I'm sure.
Yeah, so that's Michael Riley. And now apparently anyone in the newsroom who is curious about, whenever there's a cyber angle to one of their stories, they can go talk to him and he can give them the good oil on that. So it'll be interesting to see how that works out. Let's just put it that way. GitHub does security alerts. They scan repos, right? looking for bugs, and then they alert the maintainers of those repos. This was an initiative that kicked off, I think, maybe a couple of years ago, but they're expanding it some more, and now they're supporting PHP projects. This sort of thing, I think, is fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, it's the sort of thing that an organization like GitHub is really well placed to do because they have such a lot of visibility across such a large set of code bases. The real value here is that they're doing dependency tracking, analyzing programmatically what dependencies a particular piece of software has. In the case of PHP, it's support for the Composer framework for doing dependencies. So they can walk the dependency tree and then tell you about vulnerabilities further up in your supply chain so that that you have to go and rebuild your software with, updated libraries so-and-so from upstream somewhere. And that's a thing that's, is really hard to do, in an environment where this, the supply chain is such a mess. And so anything GitHub can do to help that has been good. And we've seen it work well, in the other languages, other ecosystems that they've supported it. So yeah, good job them.
Yeah. And they've just been given the authority to issue CVEs of their own, right? Which I think is pretty rad. It's real funny too, considering how in a flap everyone got when Microsoft bought GitHub. Everyone's like, no, it's all over. And they just keep doing awesome stuff.
Yeah, well, Microsoft does seem to be, embracing the whole open source thing pretty well. And yeah, GitHub, they have not yet ruined. So good job, Microsoft, as well.
So weird, man. Google and Microsoft swapped. They just swapped. It's so weird. Oh, shit. Okay, here's my bug of the week. And this is one of those ones that might slide by and you wouldn't pay attention to it. But there's an ODA out there on vBulletin. And there's a lot of vBulletin out there. A lot of forums are going to get a whole bunch of owned, man. Like, this is going to be, like, I expect next week when we do this show to be talking about the chaos that's going to ensue from this.
Yeah, this bug is pretty bad. Like, it's straight up shell command execution
in vBulletin. No way. I mean, you've used it. Right? It just has that robust feeling. Like, you think, this isn't needlessly complicated. What could go wrong here?
Yeah. So, I mean, the exploit is literally like 5 lines of code. It's pretty grim. And affects vBulletin 5 up to most recent. It was dropped as 0-day on full disclosure, which is also quite a classic way of doing things.
People are still dropping stuff on full disk? What year is this?
The kids are all right, clearly.
I didn't even know full disk was still running, man. Like, I'm amazed.
Mailing list sort of running by itself, Mary Celesting through the internet, I'm sure. The only thing really saving the vBulletin ecosystem is that most people who run vBulletin probably haven't upgraded to 5 yet. So you have to use different bugs to own all the vBulletin. So,
That's something. We've got another Microsoft story here. Actually, I probably should have lumped them together, but they've released an out-of-band security update for an IE 0-day. And there's also a bug in Defender where it's not scanning. It's reporting that it scanned after like 5 seconds, but it hasn't clearly scanned. So, they've pumped out an out-of-band update. It happens.
Yeah, the IE one was at least being used in the wild. I think the Google Threat Analysis team spotted it. So we're not clear if that's China as well or whether it was somebody else. But, IE O-Day, I guess, is newsworthy still. I mean, we've had a lot of them over the years. But, out-of-band patches are a thing people need to take seriously. So, I hope you've practiced patching lately.
An update on those pen testers in Iowa. And, it turns out our instincts on that were correct, that there may have been a little bit of scope confusion there. Now, for those of you who missed the story, a couple of pen testers got arrested for breaking into a courthouse. They said that it was part of their pen test and they were authorized to be there. But apparently that's a bit more of an open question, right?
Yeah, it does seem that there was a little bit of confusion as to whether, the state officials that they were working for had authorized them to do physical intrusion, but then they hadn't really conveyed that to, the local, local county or whatever it was, and they did not take kindly to not being in the loop, and, all of a sudden, their rules of engagement, which didn't include physical intrusion into the courthouse in question, that they didn't really want to hear about it, and they got themselves arrested by the local cops, who had no sympathy, it seems.
Yes. So we've actually got some documents there from, Coalfire Security, outlining the scope and whatever. And it looks like, they did actually have, they did actually scope it out okay, but maybe they weren't as careful as they should have been.
Yeah, well, I mean, I guess if you're going to be inside a courthouse, you know, with lockpicks, then yeah, probably want to be doing it pretty carefully and be very sure what you're doing.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm not exactly sure when this is going to court, but yeah, we'll see. We'll see what happens to them. I don't think it's going to amount to much personally. Now, Adam, we're going to close out this week's news with a Twitter thread from CyberGibbons that you sent me, because we love talking about hacking on boats. And this is a whole thread about Mr. Gibbons hacking a boat.
Yeah, apparently he was rolling a review on board a boat and they found a piece of equipment on the deck of said boat that no one really knew what it was for, what it did. And it goes through his story of trying to, you know, trace the cabling and figure out exactly what this device is. Turns out it's plugged into the engine of the boat and was installed by a third-party vendor that isn't, you know, around anymore. And yeah, it's a great story about exactly what the reality of control systems are like, not just on boats, I'm sure. But yeah, if you're interested in boat hacking, totally worth a read.
Well, I mean, you left out the best bit, which is this orphaned box that everybody had forgotten about was running TeamViewer.
Well, I mean, of course it's running TeamViewer. Everything that involves industrial control systems runs TeamViewer on the internet.
Yeah, it turns out the commercial arrangement with that third-party vendor stopped in 2014. So there you go. Everything is fine, Adam. That's the moral of the story, isn't it? We should call this the Everything Is Fine show, the Everything Is Fine podcast with Patrick Gray and Adam Boileau. What do you think?
Yeah, it might catch on. I don't know.
Yeah, time for a rebrand. That's what I say.
Time for a rebrand, exactly. Yeah.
Well, my friend, it's been a pleasure, as always, to chat to you about all of the wonderful, positive developments in this space of information security. It's been a real pleasure, my friend, and we'll do it all again next week.
Yes, we will indeed. I'll talk to you then, Pat.
That was Adam Boileau there with a look at the week's security news. Big thanks to him for that. And just a quick note, I used a podcasting interview platform called Ringer to record that interview without realizing that it caps audio at 11 kilohertz and does auto ducking. So if you're wondering why that conversation sounded like a potato, now you know. I've got a couple more interviews in the can from Ringer that I recorded before I realized these things. But yeah, I will not be using it anymore. Yuck. And sorry about that. Also, don't forget, Adam works for Insomnia Security, a New Zealand-based security consultancy. They are very good at what they do, and they do service the US market. So if you have some interesting work, you need done some red teaming or app testing, that sort of stuff, do hit them up at insomniasec.com. The quality of the team that Insomnia has assembled over the last decade is pretty amazing. So yeah, strong endorse, obviously. Okay, it is time for this week's sponsor interview now with Cody Wood of Signal Sciences. Cody is a lead application security engineer at Signal Sciences, and they make, of course, what everyone calls these days a next generation web application firewall. And you can buy and deploy it as software to run on your web servers or inline. And these days, you can also get it as a cloud service. And yeah, the topic today that we're discussing with Cody is HTTP request smuggling. Now, I'm not going to lie. When I first spoke about HTTP request smuggling with Adam a few weeks back, I was pretty hazy on what it actually was. James Kettle of PortSwigger fame had talked about it. He spoke about it at Black Hat this year. And yeah, that's why we discussed it in the news. And I've since done some reading on it, and I've got what I think is a reasonable explanation that I can relay now to some of my time poor listeners who haven't had a chance to actually read up on it. Now, the whole thing hinges on differences in the way various bits of web gear interpret headers in web requests. By including two headers in your web request, the content length and transfer encoding headers, and by carefully selecting your parameters, you can actually trick the web service into treating a request you specify to be attributed to the next user who comes along. So they get a response for a request that you transmitted. Now, at this point, you're probably thinking, you know, how does that work? And so did I. And the part that I previously didn't understand that I do now understand is that load balancers and various bits of web plumbing actually reuse connections. They reuse the same TCP connection on the back end, and they rely on these headers to determine where web requests start and stop. Rot-roll. And yeah, so you can also play around with adding spaces or tabs along with some of these headers to trigger discrepancies in how they're processed, and you can have all sorts of fun there as well. So by playing around with these headers, you can cause some confusion about where your request actually ends. And if you can trick, say, a load balancer into thinking your request ends before it does, but still get a second request on the wire, you can basically append a whole other request to the end of yours that gets treated as like a preloaded request on the socket just waiting for the next user. So you fire off your smuggled request. The first part of your request is acted on and returned to you, but the second part sits on that connection waiting for another user to come along. And when they do, it's your request, your preloaded request, that gets processed for them, not theirs. Now, when you start chaining this together with various other techniques like cross-site scripting and cache poisoning, this whole thing becomes a pretty powerful technique. And there's a whole other side to this involving injecting responses as well that can allow you to steal responses that were destined for other users. That's a whole other complicated side to this that I can't explain yet, right? And I guess what it comes down to here is we're talking about this connection chain, right? This request chain as basically being a first in, first out style queue. And attackers can mess with the order of things because various hops in the chain of tech that process web requests can't agree on how to process headers. So not surprisingly, fixing this is going to be pretty hard, right? Because it's all about discrepancies in the way people interpret various RFCs. So this technique was first described in 2005, but as I mentioned earlier, James Kettle of PortSwigger has made it news again by showing that, yep, in 2019, this technique is not only viable, but you can use it in all sorts of places. So Signal Sciences obviously took a good look at this research because this is the type of stuff that they try to protect their customers from. And the good news is they can protect users against this type of thing. I guess some bad news is that that's kind of architecture dependent. And further, you're unlikely to be running a WAF everywhere, right? So it might be good at protecting your primary sites, and that's great. But there's a lot of opportunities to do bad things with HTTP request smuggling. So yeah, in short, it's not simple. And Cody Wood joined me to talk about how on earth we fix this. And here's what he had to say.
James Kettle said, like, really the only foolproof method to address this is to upgrade HTTP2, which, like, that's a big ask for any business. Like, there's no businesses like not already maybe looking to do that, but to say like you can't protect yourself unless you do this, like that's a big ask. And what it is just a fundamental breakdown that's been there, but I don't think a lot of us realize like what the impact could be. Like if I could smuggle the request in and then get a response for someone else, like that's mind-blowing. I don't even have to use attacks anymore or use that to get cross-site scripting attacks or chain other things. It's like we have a whole new vector into making attacks, and the bug bounties are really lighting up. And I expect to see a lot more write-ups coming out. And like I've seen, you know, I kind of keep an eye on that in the industry, the bug bounty reports. But we're seeing some really interesting chaining of request smuggling to do some really, really, you know, high value vulnerabilities.
Well, and this thing, it's not so much a vulnerability as a technique, right? Which is another thing that makes it interesting, is because every time you want to use this, most of the time you're going to be using it in a different way to the last time you used it.
Right. And it's not something that you purposely like misconfigure. It's just like you put two things together and then unexpectedly talk to each other in different ways. Like, and so it's like the vulnerability was by using it. Like it wasn't even a configuration. It's just the mismatch. And you weren't even aware until some attacker starts hitting it. So yeah, it's used that way. And then it's used to exploit. So yeah, it is definitely like a technique, which makes it much harder to identify, much harder to protect against. And then that's kind of where we came into play, is we did a lot of, you know, once we heard about this, we kind of gathered all the, you know, all the people that we could on who could help address this. So agent team, and we brought in this developer, and then we brought in someone else who's working directly on the agents as a whole. And we tried to understand like, when can this happen? What load balancer needs to be in front of what reverse proxy with us and what sequence? When does that mismatch happen? And we finally narrowed it down that we have a new configuration option that will send a connection close when both of those headers are present. And so when both are present, the server can then respond via our agent with a connection close, and it closes that open connection between the two, you know, the client and the server. They're no longer able to talk to each other, and you can't, you can get maybe the request smuggled in, but you can't get that connection coming back out. And we're still actively working on also rules that detect this. And it is really an interesting technique that I think is sort of a whole new area for bug bounty and both, you know, Blue Team to start to understand better.
But I mean, you can only do something about this when you're either the first or the last hop in the chain, right? Between the web application and the internet. And I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, and that was sort of the tough thing we ran into is we didn't really understand where we came into play, and we don't always understand how our implementation is out in the field, and like it could change, and like even somebody might report to us, there's two proxies in front of us. We're not always sure like what order they were, what's expected from them. And so it can be actually smuggled past us. And so if it's smuggled past us, like we can't, I mean, it's at a lower layer, like it's not at the application layer anymore. It's not like it's below that. It's what are the data layers actually at that point? So it's at a point that we can't really do anything about it. So once it's smuggled around, it makes it really difficult to address. And so we're just trying to give our customers, you know, the best tool set we can, and also try to understand, you know, where can we protect it to the maximum best value, at least to detect it early so they can start to address it.
Now, let's just roll back and talk a little bit more about the attacks themselves. So walk us through a couple of different attack scenarios here and, you know, what the attacker would be trying to achieve and how they would achieve it.
Yeah, so the particular one that we were looking at was web cache poisoning. So the one we were looking at was a load balancer, our reverse proxy, and then we also had, I think it was like a Flask app or something like that. And so we were trying to see like where was this happening. And basically what it boiled down to is one of them, and I can't recall exactly which one, if the transfer encoding was space padded, so if I had an extra space at the end of it, it would cause the request to be smuggled. And so that was, we didn't even realize that for like actually a couple of days. We had this payload that we knew was working that was reported to us, but it was the space at the end of the transfer encoding which allowed this attack to happen. So basically somewhere along the chain, one saw the transfer encoding, the other one normalized it, took the space out, and then said, oh, okay, this is transfer encoding. So what would happen is I had a, you know, endpoint we just called like a Razzle Dazzle or something. And then you would send a request to that. And then if you use the same like user agent, you know, usually what caches are based on is, you know, the user agent and the source, so that they don't hit the same resource over and over, I would hit the Razzle Dazzle endpoint. And instead of being returned Razzle Dazzle, I would get returned another endpoint that we set up called Smuggled. And so I'd actually get the response from a different request. And so you can think of it even just like an XSS exploit or something. If you have a stored XSS on the server, but you wanted to return on the login page. If you have maybe a spoofed login page that you want returned. And I think that was actually one of the examples that James Kettle covered, was a PayPal bug bounty where he was spoofing the login page at PayPal like /login. And so it was like, it was really a big deal just by smuggling that request in, that cache was poisoned, and then it caused the page to be loaded from a different source.
Yeah, right. So, I mean, once that cache is poisoned, like what, a certain number of people are going to wind up hitting that poisoned page when they're trying to go to /login?
That's one of the possible exploits, is that you would poison, you know, a response from, you know, the login page or the about page, even for defacing. The desynchronization one was actually like probably by far the most interesting one. That's where he was receiving responses from different users. And so what happened is that connection would come in and yours would hit first and your message would be interjected in someone else's response. And you'd get a response back from someone else. And so if your embedded request was like a login cookies endpoint or something with like a CSERF, it would return a session cookie for someone else entirely. And so that's basically just ripping, you know, sensitive information out of the application just by smuggling in what you want from it. And that desynchronization is by far probably the more interesting and, you know, bigger exploit out of all the chains that I saw.
So it seems like to fix this, you can deploy technologies like yours. I'm sure you're not the only ones doing this, where if the technology is deployed at the first hop or the last hop in between the real world and the web application, you can do things like disallow requests that have both of those headers, right? Like that seems like a reasonable thing. But obviously, you know, not everyone's running security software across
everything that they have on the internet, right? And that's not necessarily going to be feasible. So at some point, this is going to need to be fixed. Where do you fix this? It's going to be the reverse proxy makers, like anyone who's making any technology that handles web requests, you know, web server makers, proxy makers, they're the ones who are going to have to fix this, right? And that's a lot of people.
Yeah, and that's, I mean, I wish I could answer that question, like, how are we going to fix it? It's sort of like, you know, because one web server might decide, like, okay, we're going to standardize and follow the RFC exactly as we interpret it to be. How to handle tab plus space or whatever, we trim it off. But maybe there's one unique implementation that breaks, and so they try to accommodate it. But then over here, like, the reverse proxy people are trying to address some whole other use case and come up with some whole other assumption of how it should work. And when those disagree is sort of the problem. And so we're almost talking like a fundamental breakdown in human communications on what we agree on. Like, we know standards, but interpretations vary. Like, it does, it's very hard to fix this. HTTP2 is really the only foolproof one. Again, you can use our product. We also have like request rules. You can detect when both headers are present. If that's something that your application does not expect, you can reject it outright. You're like, we just won't take this kind of request as two of these in here. Then you have to worry about some of the edge cases where you got to look for spaces in headers and things like that. And yeah, again, our product can help there. But what, I mean, this is kind of maybe sound fanboy for PortSwigger, but they actually have an extension that helps like launch the smuggling probes. So that's actually what I'd recommend is first like determine if your company or your organization, your application, wherever you're working with is vulnerable to this. Does it react differently? Is there something about your proxy chains that you don't understand?
PortSwigger have got some tooling that'll let you check for that, right? That seems like out of everything in this interview, that seems like the most actionable thing someone could do.
Definitely, you could get it. I think it's only comes with a pro version or something. So like, and even if it doesn't, there's still a lot of research in that white paper that you could start to manufacture your own requests. One word of warning, though, is if you use curl or some of the command line tools to send requests, they make their own assumptions about how to handle transfer encoding content length. And so when you're thinking that you're sending that request out like it's going to be, that's not actually what's making the server. Like, some of these we actually had to like just build from Netcat and like send it directly because we wanted to know it's exactly what it was. And even Burp out of the box as well made some assumptions and handles transfer encoding before it hits the application itself. So this is really a tricky thing.
So you were typing out full HTTP requests with headers and everything into Netcat, yes, and then hitting enter, yes, and waiting for a response.
Yes, yes. Eventually we got like smart enough to, you know, build it into a script and stuff like that. But we're sending curl and we're like, why isn't it working? It's not making any sense. I put the header there, like, man. Sure. And then so we set a Netcat listener on the load balancer, like, oh, that's what it gets. Okay. That's not what we expected. And so we just kept like fighting this whack-a-mole of like, oh, I thought I sent it, but what really got sent was this. Okay, let's adjust our tool that we're using. Okay, it's sending what we want, but then this one sends something else. We'll add a space to it, add a tab to it. And it was like, it was unexpected every time in every situation we went through. We did IIS, we did every sort of combination of different proxies and services. And almost everyone was different, and you couldn't make any assumption on how they handled it.
That's kind of what I was saying before about how it's more of a technique, right, than an exploit or a vulnerability. And this is why I think, pen testers and bug bounty people are going to have a lot of fun with this, and you know they're gonna be the ones to a large degree, at least in the short to medium term, they're going to be the ones to sort this out for us, aren't they?
Yeah, that's kind of, they'll at least be the driving force behind it, right? The continual nudge of like, if you guys don't fix this, some really bad stuff is going to happen. And I think that's going to help us, you know, if nothing, is that we continuously get more exotic attacks from it. But yeah, that's in technique is just, you know, sort of mind blowing for me. I didn't, like, this is back to shell shock. It's like the internet's broken. I was like,
well, I mean, if you're getting, you know, if you're able to send requests and get people's session cookies back, I mean, it's a lot like, this reminds me more of like Heartbleed, right? Where you could actually get little chunks of memory out, right?
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Just give me your cookies.
Based on the rate of the bug bounty reports and the difficulty of A, understanding how it works, and then B, implementing a fix for it. Like, those two things combined, think left businesses in a really difficult position of like not knowing what to do. Where do we detect that? How do we detect it? How do we know it's processing what? And yeah, sure, we can help out with like power rules and like checking, you know, adding signals to what requests have which headers and what order they come in. But it's very difficult for a business without those kind of tools to just like out of the box even test this. And right now,
that's most businesses, right?
It's Burp Suite. Yeah. And Burp Suite is really definitely the best tool that, I mean, I use it this whole time that we've been investigating it, and it's got some great smuggling and probing and attacking tools. And I mean, shout out to all that research. I'm a big fan.
Oh man. I mean, James Kettle. He had some crazy stuff last year. He had some crazy stuff this year. And of course he's, you know, Work Support Swigger, which makes Burp Suite. So it makes sense that their tooling is good for this. And I can't wait to see what he comes up with in 2020, but Cody Wood, thanks a lot for joining us to, walk us through this stuff. I'm sure, you've sufficiently put the fear into a number of our listeners, and I thank you for it. Cheers.
All right. Thanks, Patrick.
That was Cody Wood of Signal Sciences there. Big thanks to him for that. And big thanks to Signal Sciences for its support of the Risky Business Podcast. You can find them at signalsciences.com. Just a heads up, after next week's show, I'll be taking a couple of weeks off. And I know a lot of you will be like, damn, Patrick, you're taking a lot of holidays lately. And to that, I say, yes, I am, because life isn't all about work, even when you love your job, which I do. I do hope you've enjoyed this week's show. Anyway, I do hope you've enjoyed listening to this week's show as much as I did putting it together, but that is it from me today. I'll be back tomorrow with a Snake Oilers edition, but until then, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.